and welcome to episode number 72 of the Web 2.0 Show. I'm your host, Adam Stachowiak. This edition of the Web 2.0 Show is brought to you by the Web 2.0 Expo in San Francisco. Also brought to you by Grasshopper and Store Envy. In this episode, we're going to talk with Eric Reese. He is the author of the blog Startup Lessons Learned and the creator of the Lean Startup Methodology. I actually met up with Eric a couple nights ago on Monday night at the Chargeify party at South by Southwest, which is kind of cool. If you go to the blog, you'll see a picture of me and Eric. In that picture, I'm wearing a Web 2.0 Show t-shirt thanks to StoreEnvy.com. StoreEnvy is a brand new sponsor of the Web 2.0 Show. They're a social shopping and free online store community. Go to StoreEnvy.com right now to get your free account and free online store. That's StoreEnvy.com. I want to thank Grasshopper.com for sponsoring the show. We do this very cool thing called Pitch the Show. If you call me at 1-888-WEB20SHOW, you can give me your best 90-second pitch about you and your business and what you and your startup are doing. And myself, David, C-Mac, and Jonathan, we're going to go through all the requests we get to come on the show, all the pitches we get, and select just two each month to go on a special episode of the Web 2.0 Show called Pitch the Show. If you want to learn more, go to web20show.com/pitch. I want to thank the Web 2.0 Expo for sponsoring the show. Head to web2expo.com/SF to learn more and register. To get 25% off, enter WEBSF10BD5. Or to get a free Expo Hall pass, enter WEBSF10BDE. And if you're not following me and you're not following the show, head to twitter.com right now and follow Adam STAC. That's me, Adam Stack. And also follow the show, Web20Show. And thanks for listening. I'm here with Eric Reese of Startup Lessons Learned and Lean Startup Fame, also accompanied by Caitlin Pike, the Marketing and Community Manager at the Web 2.0 Expo. Hello, Eric. Hello, Caitlin.
Hey, hello. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Eric, why don't we start with you? Give us a kind of a brief intro to who you are and what you do, and we'll follow up with Caitlin so we can kind of get the intros settled up.
Sure. Yeah, I've been an entrepreneur now for about 10 years. You know, I grew up programming computers and have always been a technologist by trade. And then when I started to do entrepreneurship, I started to notice that it took more than just having a great piece of technology to have a successful product or a successful business. And so I've been kind of working my way through those issues. How do you figure out how to build a business around a successful product? How do you turn a technology into a successful product in the first place? And then, you know, recently started writing this blog called Startup Lessons Learned and have been evangelizing this methodology called the Lean Startup, you know, basically a different way of building new products and new companies.
Very cool. Caitlin, and who are you and what do you do?
So I'm the community and marketing manager for Web 2.0 Expo. And that means if you ever follow us on Twitter at W2E or if you are on our Facebook fan page or in our LinkedIn group, I'm the voice behind the brand. So if you ask any questions, I'm the one answering them during our shows. We have a show coming up in May 3rd through 6th in San Francisco. If you have any questions during the conference, you can tweet at us and I'll answer. For our New York show this past fall, I was the one answering any questions or monitoring the Twitter stream during the keynotes. So that's some of what I do. I do the other marketing efforts as well.
Oh, very cool.
Any questions, just ask me.
So the veil has been lifted and now we know who is behind all this everything out there for Web 2.0 Expo. Awesome.
It actually is a real person with a real voice, not just a bot doing it, I assure you.
Right. And you got a great team, too. I mean, you guys are doing a bunch of stuff on the blog. You guys are pretty active this year. And I don't know how active you guys were last year, but you guys are pretty active this year, doing lots of stuff with giveaways and PDFs and stuff like that.
Yeah, we want to be a better resource to our community. Instead of just having the conference twice a year, we want to make it more of a year-round thing and help people in whatever efforts they're doing, either through design or development, social media marketing, whatever we can do to help.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And that's a reason why we're here today. This is a special episode of the Web 2.0 Show. Audience, as you've heard in the last couple episodes, I've mentioned that the Web 2.0 Expo is sponsoring the show, and I've been working with Caitlin on getting some early buzz, and that's why we're talking to Eric today. Eric is going to be speaking there. Eric, you're doing a keynote there, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right.
And you're also doing an intensive called Lean Startup Intensive?
Yes, that's going to be May 3rd.
Awesome, awesome. So, Eric, I don't know if you really know this, but I've been a huge fan of yours and your blog for quite some time. And, all of the guests that I've had recently have been huge fans of what you're doing in the world of startups and the evangelism you're doing and the blog you write. Why don't we get started off with telling everyone about the blog and kind of where the idea came from?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you very much for the kind words. That's I'm very grateful. Certainly no one's been more surprised than I have been at the level of response that the blog has generated. It's been really, really gratifying and actually pretty humbling. I started writing it really as a hobby after I had left my most recent company and was thinking about what I wanted to do next. And I was being asked to kind of act as an advisor to a lot of entrepreneurs. So I was sitting on a lot of advisory boards and working with a bunch of VCs about ways to take what I had learned in previous companies and apply them to new startups. And some of the advice that I would give people, I started to realize struck them as crazy. Because it only made sense if you understood the context of, you know, certain entrepreneurial principles that I had been thinking about for a long time. But from the point of view of the traditional development models that most people use, something like continuous deployment, which is the, you know, putting new code into production potentially dozens of times a day, that doesn't seem like it should be able to work. And so some people gave me the answer, listen, that's impossible. You can't, that can't happen. And I would say, no, I'm not telling you what you should do. I'm just telling you what I have successfully done in the past. So it's not theoretical. It's actually very practical. But then quite a few people would say, well, you know, maybe that worked for you, but it doesn't work for me because, and then they had some reason. I'm in a different industry. My company's a different size. We have a different skill set, you know, what have you. And I started to want to figure out, well, how can I give them advice that is generally useful without having to insist that everybody do everything the same way, which obviously doesn't work. And I felt like when I was an entrepreneur, I found that really frustrating. A lot of people wanted to give advice that was just, listen, I did this thing in the past, and then I was very successful, so if you do that same thing, you'll be successful too. And I would say, well, how do you know? How do you know it works across industries? How do you know it works across company sizes? How do you know it works across time? So just because it worked in the past, how do you know it'll work in the future? And so I started to write down some of my ideas. At first I thought I would just send people these essays and say, look, take a look at the blog. And if you think I'm crazy, then you won't have to waste your time having me as an advisor. You can go get somebody who's more to your liking. And then, you know, as I started to clarify my own thinking, this theory of the lean startup emerged, you know, which actually was a set of principles for understanding why certain practices work for startups, but for example, don't work for big companies. Or why certain processes give startups an advantage over big companies or even over their competitors, you know, depending on the circumstance. So that was really the origin of the blog. Obviously, I'm indebted to a number of theorists who've come before, you know, Steve Blank and his customer development model, Kent Beck and the whole Agile movement, and there are quite a few other bloggers who are doing really good work now, Sean Ellis, Dave McClure, Andrew Chen, but, you know, that's how it all started.
So the perspective of the blog is exactly what it titled. It's Lessons Learned.
That's right. And it started out, you know, as war stories. But I felt like the way to make those stories useful to people was really to get underneath the artifacts of what happened and into the real questions of why. How did it work? Why would that work again? You know, why did you make that choice? And kind of how do you correlate the cause and effect of those different practices? That really has been my focus, you know, from the beginning.
I guess it's kind of tough too. I mean, if you write a blog, especially coming from the perspective or at least talking about the things you're talking about, it might be easy to assume that you're saying that this is how it should be done versus this is how you did it and this is how it worked for you.
And yeah, I really wanted to start with that as a foundation to say there's a lot of theory out there. And in fact, a lot of the bad theory that actually is harmful to startups is good theory in some other context. So I meet people often who have stories for me about how they hired an MBA to run their company, their startup, and bad things happened because the MBA brought with them assumptions about general management that they tried to apply to startups. And then some people misinterpret that to mean like, oh, well, I just don't hire MBAs. MBAs are bad. But that's completely wrong. What you got to recognize is that MBAs have been trained, most of them anyway, in a very specific theory of general management that can't be directly transplanted into a startup. But that doesn't mean that the managerial discipline that they learned is bad. It just means the specific practices need to be tweaked and adapted, understanding that entrepreneurship is a context in which unknowns, the unknown dominates all of our thinking. Whereas in a traditional company, you know, where we're building a follow-on product, something we've built before, or we're serving a customer segment we already know extremely well, you know, the situation that, that Clay Christensen would call sustaining innovation. In those situations, advanced planning, building like detailed models, competitive research, all of those tools of general management are actually very effective. And so it's really important for us as entrepreneurs to not try to denigrate the general managers who run the modern global supply chains that keep us all alive. I mean, they're doing really important work. The theorists of the 20th century who worked out those principles and brought it to life, like, we owe them a tremendous debt of gratitude. And also, those principles are not universally applicable. They work only in a certain context. Entrepreneurship is just a different managerial context.
So the lean startup methodology, is it just tech related? Is there a specific niche in business that it's related to, or is it just sort of a methodology that's a guideline to follow and veer from the path when you need to apply to your business?
Well, I'll answer the question in two ways. The first is, just to be clear in case there's anybody who gets confused, the lean startup is not a religion. It is a way of thinking about business problems, you know, in context of innovation and entrepreneurship, and the specific practices that the guys like I and Steve, you know, suggest, they're not rigid and they're not designed to say, look, you have to do it this way or else. It's not a dogma. On the other hand, I do believe that the principles have explanatory power. That is, you can look at a situation, and in my consulting practice, I often get asked to do this, to come into a situation. People will describe how they're working, what their process is, and then I can make predictions about what's actually happening for their customers, what's actually happening in their product, because the outputs of the company are determined by the process that people in the company use. And so that's the way that I think about it. Any time where process thinking and unknowns intersect, the lean startup is going to be very powerful. I don't think it's about specific industries. I don't think it's about tech versus not tech, internet versus non-internet, although, frankly, everybody's in the internet business now, whether they want to be or not. You know, it's not really an optional thing, because if your customers are on the internet, then you have to be on the internet. That's too bad. And as soon as you're using the internet in any way in your business, you're in the software business even if you didn't want to be. So it's not a choice that people get to make anymore. But I think the principles, you know, which are drawn from lean manufacturing, which are drawn from agile development, something called maneuver warfare and the OODA loop from a guy named John Boyd, those principles I think are universally applicable, again, as long as the context is right. And so, like, people always ask me, well, what is a startup, right? How do you know if you're in a startup or not? And I'll just – this is the definition I use. A startup is a human institution designed to create something new under conditions of extreme uncertainty. And so you don't have to be two guys in a garage to be confronting extreme uncertainty. In fact, a lot of people are basically involuntary entrepreneurs. They went to join some supposedly safe company in a supposedly safe industry, and they discovered, oh my God, uncertainty is everywhere because, you know, industries are being disrupted left and right thanks to the internet. And those people, I think, are every bit as much entrepreneurs as the guys in a garage. And so we need to recognize that they have common interest, you know, common interests. They can make common cause and use common techniques to be successful.
And this is the underlying foundation of the lean startup methodology?
Yes, that's right.
Awesome. And this is something that you're covering at this intensive at the Web 2.0 Expo. May 3rd?
May 3rd.
Is the day of your intensive?
I appreciate the plug. Yes, exactly. It'll be all day May 3rd. That's the first day of the Web 2.0 Expo at Moscone. And it's going to be we're going to try to give people a comprehensive introduction to the lean startup theory. So people who, you know, completely new to it, people who find themselves under conditions of extreme uncertainty in any kind of career, we hope they'll get something out of it. And we always design these programs. A lean startup is one of these things that cuts across functional boundaries. So our experience has been, you know, teaching people these ideas that it works the best when we have technical and non-technical people in the same room, preferably even from the same company. We always encourage people to come in pairs or, you know, however many decision makers need to be there, so that people can kind of hear the message together and immediately go into brainstorming mode about how they could break down the functional barriers that are preventing them from doing the, you know, what we call validated learning about customers, the unit of progress that we evangelize as part of the lean startup.
You know, I get so kind of passionate. I get so passionate about entrepreneurship and kind of where that stems from. And there's been a number of you know, tweets going back and forth on Twitter. I partner with a company called Grasshopper, which they do their best to empower entrepreneurs. They have a very awesome virtual phone system that small businesses and entrepreneurs can cling to make themselves very, you know, to follow lean methodologies, which is keeping their costs low. Mm-hmm. But and what they do to sort of foster entrepreneurship. Do you think that being an entrepreneur is something that you're born with? Is it DNA? Is it something you learn? I mean, where does the spirit of an entrepreneur come from in your eyes?
This is one of those perennial questions, like, you know, nature versus nurture, that I don't have a strong opinion about. I think guys like Vivek Wadhwa, who's been doing a lot of research into, who's an academic, who's doing research into the actual data about entrepreneurship, is in a much better position to answer a question like that than I am, because I think there is actually empirical data to be looked at. But my personal bias is that people overemphasize the innate qualities of entrepreneurs. Like, one thing you'll hear is that if you want to be an entrepreneur, you have to be tenacious and persistent and, you know, give 120%. And of course, persistence is awesome unless you're busy persisting your plane right into the ground, right? You also have to be adaptable and flexible in the face of, you know, difficulties and have the passion to want to weave around those difficulties to get to your final destination. So given that, yeah, I think it's tough to say, well, that there's certain people who are just, you know, made to be entrepreneurs. That said, you know, to me, what I look for when I meet with an entrepreneur is this paradoxical combination of having a really strong, really big vision and also a very practical focus on the near-term objectives they need to reach in order to demonstrate that vision is attainable. And I have found that most people find that to be really an unpleasant experience, because you're kind of simultaneously trying to hold in your head the idea that your vision is brilliant, it's absolutely going to happen, it's going to change the world, and also there are probably elements of that vision that are wrong. And, you know, holding those two ideas at the same time can give people quite a headache.
Yeah, I bet. So the reason why I asked you that question is, you know, you've got a history of being an entrepreneur yourself. And you put yourself out there in this blog, and, you know, for lack of better terms, you have an opportunity to be on a pedestal and help a lot of people and guide a lot of people. But sometimes the question comes as well, why should you be the guide? And I imagine you have some awesome stories about your earlier experiences. So could you share a few experiences that leverage that I guess catapult you up and say, this is why I write this blog, and this is, you know, this is kind of why I should be listened to?
Yeah, well, I'll certainly tell you my background, and of course your listeners can judge for themselves whether that makes me qualified to be a person to listen to. But let me give a word of caution about that, because I feel like quite often we fall into this trap that the people who are the most successful are the people who you should listen to the most, which I think is an understandable human instinct. And yet I'm not sure that it's actually very helpful. Because what we really need to be doing, I think, as entrepreneurs, is looking for ideas that can be tested and validated. And if you follow any kind of scientific process, having a falsifiable hypothesis is really important. And a lot of the advice you get, you know, way out of context from people who just say, hey, you should do this, you should do that, because that's what I did. You know, how do you prove or disprove that that's correct? So to me, I would prefer that my work be judged on the basis of whether the ideas themselves make sense, and when people try them, they get a positive result as a result of trying them. And you can try them in small parts. So a lot of advice is like, listen, it's all or nothing. You either do it entirely my way or it's a waste of time. And I really don't believe in that. I think, you know, we want to take advice in small batches, test and see, hey, is this actually moving us in the right direction? And I encourage everybody to judge for yourself. But since you asked, the, you know, companies that I've been involved in, I did my first startup back in the dot-com bubble. It was a complete disaster. I used to believe in those days that you just build a great product and build a great technology, and you can kind of delegate all the business stuff to somebody else.
You kind of went in blind. You were a little naive about what was involved.
Absolutely. I mean, all I knew about entrepreneurship was every day I'm reading in magazines about these guys who walked into some VC's office and got a $10 million check, and next thing you know, they're rich and famous. And their ideas didn't seem any better than my ideas, so I figured, you know, what the heck, I'll just – I can write that kind of software. That's no problem. And I really thought that, you know, we built this product. It was for consumers. I won't go into the details, but it was, you know, to help people find jobs. And so there was a consumer piece and then an employer piece. And we figured we'd get the consumers signed up, get them in our database, and then we'd sell access to employers. That would be no problem. And because our algorithms were cutting edge and because the technology was superior to anything else that was on the market, we'd have no trouble making the sale. And if any of your listeners have ever tried to do something like I just described, they will be laughing now to know exactly what's going to happen next, which is it was no problem getting people to sign up. The problem was we didn't have an infrastructure for building some kind of business model or sales process out of it. And it was, you know, it was very painful failure when the NASDAQ crashed. You know, it all came apart. And as we say in Silicon Valley, it was a good learning experience. And after that, I felt like, well, I better go learn from the pros. You know, kind of I tried this on my own, kind of fly by the seat of my pants, figure it out on my own. That didn't work very well. I'll go to Silicon Valley. I'll take a job at a really hot startup, you know, get in early and really meet people who I felt like I could apprentice myself to and learn as much from. And so I joined a company that was a virtual worlds company. It was a huge, very, very hyped startup in Silicon Valley, raised a lot of money, had a really, really smart, I think a stellar team involved. And that company spent something like 5 years and, you know, I don't know, $40 or $50 million in stealth R&D building a product, you know, in anticipation of a huge launch. The launch was a huge success. Tons of people, you know, all the press and everybody saying what a great product it was. The only problem was we couldn't actually get enough customers to use it and pay for it. And by the time we actually did the launch, we had such a high burn rate, such a huge company, so much momentum in a certain direction, we'd lost the agility necessary to adapt, and the company wound up really in bad shape as a result. Certainly the product launch was a failure, and, you know, all kinds of other bad stuff wound up happening.
Which one is
later.
This you're mentioning?
What's that?
Which startup is this? You're mentioning the iView?
This is a company, it was called there.com. I normally don't talk about it by name, but they literally just shut down the consumer service yesterday. And so I'm feeling kind of nostalgic this week because, you know, I left the company after that failed launch, but quite a few other people stayed and really have spent the last, you know, I don't know how many years it's been now, trying to make a go of it, trying to recover from those early mistakes. And they just, you know, I have, my heart goes out to them. I really appreciate that they tried to keep the dream alive, but they really weren't able to do it. It was, you know, it was that catastrophic of a launch.
Just give them the book, The Dip, from Seth Godin.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right? Exactly. That's the thing is, you know,
quit.
Yeah.
Like you did.
Don't quit. Don't give up. The thing will be just on the other side. And sometimes it is. And, you know, sometimes it isn't.
Let's see that you had some foresight then to quit early and look where you're at now.
It's always a matter of judgment, but all I can say is it seemed like a good idea at the time, and that, you know, it was out of the ashes of that experience that a couple of us wound up founding a company you mentioned called IMVU, and at IMVU we wanted to take some of these virtual world ideas but apply them in a completely different way. We tried to build a easy to use, lightweight version of those communication paradigms so that we could bring 3D avatars to instant messaging and then later to social networking. And, you know, so we started that company in 2004, and we really tried to make the process that we went about doing it really different. So we shipped a product really early. It was very buggy. We had customers. We were charging them money from day one. And, you know, a lot of customers hated it and thought, you know, it was a really dumb idea. But the vast majority of people just didn't care. You know, it wasn't that they tried it and didn't like it. We couldn't even get them to try it. And so if you think about that, we had spent, you know, the first couple of months, we thought we were doing a really good job. We spent only 6 months building this first prototype. But if we couldn't even get people to use the prototype, then what was the value in having built it in the first place? Couldn't we have discovered that we were fundamentally on the wrong track a little bit sooner? And it was those kinds of questions that really started to plague me after a while. You know, we built a very good process in IMVU. The company has been very successful. It's now quite profitable and doing great. But the questions, you know, that I was asking, both in the way that we tried to build that company, but then later when I started to write about it for Startup Lessons Learned, the real, you know, questions I had were, how do we know if we're making progress day to day, right? You know, most of the companies that I see in the high tech field that fail because they're fundamentally building something that nobody wants, right? There's no customers for the product when it finally launches. And so if that's the case, you know, if you're building something that nobody wants, what does it matter if you do it on schedule or on budget? What does it matter if the features are highly polished? What does it matter if it has a really good architecture? right? All these kind of questions that we normally associate with good planning and good discipline, especially those of us who are engineers with kind of the practice of our craft in a smart way, those activities can actually all turn into waste if we're not careful. And so that, you know, fast forwarding, the lean startup is really an attempt to answer those questions. How do you know if you're making progress if you're in an entrepreneurial situation that's dominated by uncertainty?
So it seems like the follow-up should be then is the thought process around the minimum viable product, the MVP.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you get to that that MVP status first or sooner, then you might actually get to see that you have customers that, don't want what you have and you can quit while you've at this minimum stage.
Well, it's the word quit that's tricky there. So I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. You know, when we talk about failing early or failing faster really is one way of thinking about it. The goal, of course, is not to have the company fail faster. We want the company to be successful. But we want to change the traditional model where idea failure often winds up equaling company failure. Instead, what we want to do is figure out, you know, as an entrepreneur, if you want to be successful, you have to kind of get 10 out of 10 things right. You have to have a product that works. It has to solve a problem that people have. The problem has to be important to them. There has to be a lot of people who share that same problem. You have to be able to reach those people. You have to be able to distribute your product to them. You have to be able to charge them money. The economics have to work, et cetera, right? So you can kind of make a list of a bunch of things that have to go right. As humans, we have this intuition that like 80% of something is 80% as good. But in this situation, you know, 8 or 9 out of 10 things is not an A, it's an F. You have to get all those things right in order for us to achieve what, you know, what Marc Andreessen calls product market fit. And so the problem is when we have a vision that's really awesome about how things are going to work in the future, the vision often can have a lot of things really right about it. You know, say 60% correct. I'm fabricating some numbers here. Well, that can feel like, wow, I must be a genius to be able to predict 60% of things about the future. But actually, that's total failure. And so what we want to do is use things like the minimum viable product to test to see whether, you know, to assume that our vision is correct. But just test, double check, make sure that each of the assumptions that underlies the vision has some reality behind it. And then what's more likely, discover, hey, a bunch of the things we think are really awesome and great and right, but a bunch aren't. And so let's chip away at those really dumb ideas and separate them from the really good ones and then, you know, eventually get our startup to be based around a product and a vision and a business model that's actually correct.
So when you say – yeah, and I've read your blog and have listened to you speak a few times. When you say take an iterative approach towards your product development and test yes. assumptions early, how you do it is through using the minimum viable product portion of the Lean Startup methodology. By getting to that piece first, you can test assumptions and test them early.
Right.
And if they're failures, they're failures, and you move on from the failures. But if they're passes, then you keep them and you roll them into the, you know, the larger product you're building.
Yeah. One of the common misconceptions about minimum viable product is that people think, well, then that's for people who want to build minimal products. But I have a big vision. I want to do something big. How can shipping a prototype in 3 months, you know, help me with my giant vision? That doesn't seem like it's really worth it. But that's exactly backwards. The purpose of the minimum viable product is it's only for people who have a big vision. So if you're trying to create something really awesome, something that's really going to change the world, then that's going to have a lot of moving parts. And the goal of the MVP is to help you figure out which of those moving parts you're right about and which ones you're wrong. So, for example, we had this idea early on at InView that customers would want to interoperate a 3D instant messaging experience with their existing IM clients. And I won't get into the strategic reasons why that seemed like a really good idea and nor into the empirical reasons why actually it turns out to be a really bad idea. But suffice to say that we were right about the core value that people wanted to use 3D avatars to socialize online, that people liked that. But the specific implementation of how we were going to get this product virally distributed through IM networks was just wrong. By building a minimal version of the product, we were able to figure that out. It became really clear from meeting with potential customers, right away that this whole add-on concept was basically a deal breaker. And so we didn't need to spend 5 years developing the most robust, most awesomest IM interoperability system because even with a pretty poor one, we could immediately tell that people didn't want to do it. Now, it was buggy. So if customers had said, hey, I really want to use this thing, but these bugs are driving me crazy, that would have been one form of feedback that might have steered us in a different direction. But what people often forget is most customers are indifferent to new products. So it's not that they say, oh, this I don't like this because it has bugs. They just refuse to use it. They won't give you any feedback about it. They you know, like I said, wouldn't even try it. And so those are the kind of signals that you have to learn to interpret to figure out which elements of your vision really make sense.
You know, as a developer, I can really reflect on a couple pieces you mentioned there, which is because I enjoy my craft, I enjoy doing it right. I enjoy doing it the right way. And I'm sure you can echo my feelings on this, is that, you know, you'd mentioned building the perfect architecture for how these things could be shared. It didn't matter. It didn't matter if it was perfect. So it didn't matter that, you know, I did an awesome job at my niche craft within this larger product. What do you tell developers then to step away from some of their core beliefs, like, you know, let's just say like BDD or test early, test often with software? How do you get people to break away from some of these linchpins in their processes to allow you to be, I guess, agile enough in this product development stage?
Yeah, it's really frustrating. You know, I used to believe that if you just followed a straight agile development methodology in a startup, you could eliminate waste from your process. Right? That's the promise of agile. And I'm a big fan of agile methodologies like extreme programming. I mean, and it's just important to recognize that they have to be adapted when the primary issue is not what, you know, how do we build the solution, but the primary issue is what problem are we even trying to solve? So, like what made me crazy was, I mentioned that IAM add-on situation that customers didn't like that fundamental feature. We wound up having to throw out tens of thousands of lines of code that I had personally written to do that interoperability.
How did that feel?
It felt awful. I was totally depressed.
10,000 lines of code is a lot of code.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you never want to throw code out. And it's like, oh, what wasted effort. I can't believe it. But what made me even more upset was I had to throw out the good code and the bad code equally. The code that was under test coverage and the code that wasn't under test code equally. The buggy code and then all that code got thrown away. And so I started to ask myself, did I just waste the last 6 months of my life building this software? I mean, would the company have been just as well off without me being here? You know, have I just been on a beach somewhere having a good time? And then I started to feel better. I said, no, I don't feel so bad, because if we hadn't done that, if we hadn't written that software and tested it with customers, we wouldn't have learned this important thing about what customers want, or in particular what they don't want, right? Does that make sense?
Totally. Totally.
But then I got depressed again, because I said, wait a minute, if the goal of the last 6 months was to learn what customers do and don't want, did I really have to write 50,000 lines of code to do it? Is there no way I could have gotten the same amount of learning out of 25,000 lines of code, right? Instead of supporting 10 instant messaging clients, what if I'd supported only 5? Well, what if I'd supported only 3? And I was like, well, what if I'd supported only 1? And then I was like, wait, if customers are refusing to even use the feature, why did I have to build it at all? Couldn't I have learned the same amount of information by, for example, talking to them? And that really got me really depressed again, because it was like, wait a minute, I'm measuring my progress as a professional by how much code I write and how good it is. But the company needs to be measuring its progress by how much we're learning about what customers want. And that disconnect really stuck with me, because in a product development situation, especially in a startup, the biggest source of waste is building something that nobody wants. And we were doing that despite our agile credentials. And that was the beginning of trying to change the way that we work, to say, no, never again. Let's never allow ourselves to have these large volumes of code that, you know, are ultimately not helping us learn. Let's do the minimum amount of work necessary to get the learning about whether our ideas are resonating with customers or not.
Now, there's two directions we can go really from here, because I see us wanting to talk about failure, and I've got a couple points I want to talk to you about on failure. But, you know, I'm kind of wanting to move over and talk about your idea of the new entrepreneurship and how that paints the picture of startups being formed around customers' needs and their problems rather than technology.
Yep.
Being very data-centric and more customer-centric. It seems like what you just described there was an area where we need to start looking at our customers more and solving their problems and concern less about technology. And if we're solving problems, then obviously we're building a product that people want to use and will buy, right?
Right.
So with this, the new entrepreneurship, and I only say the new entrepreneurship because that's what it was titled as I found it, but what can you kind of give a description of what this is? And
Yeah. You know, we've been calling it the new entrepreneurship, you know, as a way of just trying to get people to look around and say, are the traditional models about how we build startups and how we build new innovative products in enterprise, are those models actually getting very good results? You know, because I think the answer is no. If you look at the rate of failure in companies of new product introductions, it's really staggering. And academic research is very harsh on the reality of how well we're doing. Now, we expect in a high-risk business to have a certain amount of failure, and we could reduce our failure rate by taking less risk. You know, that's no good. We don't want to do that. But I think the bigger issue is how many of these companies are failing because they took too much risk. You know, when's the last time you heard a software company pitch you something and you said, boy, I wonder if that can be built? Is it possible to build that technology? The answer these days is very rarely, I'm not sure. Usually the answer is, yes, of course it can be built. The real question is, should it be built? That is, we're moving from an era that was dominated by technology risk decisions to one that's dominated by market risks. That is, customer risk. Will people want to use the product in the end? And that shift in the industry, it's creating a lot of new opportunities for entrepreneurs. So this is probably the best time in the history of the world to be an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurship has gone global in a major way, as my travels last year have let me see firsthand. It's been awesome to see. People are following these ideas about new entrepreneurship all over the world. And people can compete on an equal basis no matter where they are. So I think that's profoundly democratic. I think it's really, it's a good thing overall. But again, time after time after time, we're building companies, pouring all kinds of precious time and resources into companies that are building something that nobody wants. And I think that's a preventable problem. So the new entrepreneurship is all about building startups from the ground up to face that problem head on. So everything we do is designed to be judged by how much are we learning about customers. And if that requires building some technology, then let's build it. But if it doesn't, if that's not what it requires, if it requires us to get a designer, an engineer, and a customer in a room together and really learn from each other, then that's what we're going to do. Right, that's how we're going to evaluate every aspect of our process. So we have the simple three-stage feedback loop. This is kind of the essence of the new entrepreneurship. We start with an idea. All software companies are catalysts that turn ideas into code in a stage we call building, right? We build code. When customers interact with that code, we have the opportunity to measure what they do, which yields data. And then we can use that data to learn, which impacts our next set of ideas, right? It's a very simple three-stage feedback loop. But although it's simple, it's a very powerful idea because we can now say that the key heuristic for evaluating any piece of process in a startup is, does it minimize the total time to this feedback loop rather than sub-optimizing only one of the individual parts? So when people are trying to race to get their first product out, they'll often say something to me like, well, I don't have time to build all this analytics code into it. I just got to get my product out there, right? The theory is I can build faster if I don't measure. And I always liken that to saying, well, I could drive my car faster if I just close my eyes and slam the accelerator, right? We're mistaking speed for progress. Our goal is to get to our destination as fast as possible. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs are still confused about what the destination is. It's not the product itself. The product is only a means to an end. The end is learning. So that's, optimizing our time to that feedback loop is where all the specific practices of the lean startup come from. Continuous deployment, rapid split testing, in-person customer interviews, the whole movement of customer development that Steve Blank has pioneered. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, in this last episode, episode 70 of the Web 2.0 show, I had Ethan Block on from Flowtown, and he talked about how they probably deploy 20, 30 times a day to production.
That's right.
They're just constantly iterating. They're constantly taking feedback from their customers. They even use Sean Ellis's Survey.io to capture feedback and capture those early responses from, if I can't use this product anymore, would I be disappointed? Mm-hmm. Be completely disappointed? And I think that survey is fabulous, but actually taking the approach of deploying that much and being that involved in your code base and that involved in product iteration is astounding to me because they've done pretty well with Flowtown. But let's veer left and talk about failure real quick before we tail off. I just started to listen to Rework. Actually, last night I went to audible.com. They're not they don't sponsor the podcast, but I'm not sure. that's where I got it at. But I went to audible.com because I'm a listener of books versus a reader of books. I'd love to read books, but sometimes listening to me is just easier because I can do it while I work. I can do it while I drive. I can kind of do it anywhere, really. And so I pulled down Rework from Jason Fried and David Hanemar Hansen, And one piece they talk about in there, and it's something that sort of leverages what you do with the Lean Startup methodology, is in the Lean Startup methodology, you say fail early, fail often. But I'm confused because they say, and I'm not trying to start a fight here by any means, I'm just curious of how whose opinion is right, or you know what the contrast is. But they say they don't even look at failure. They just say, why do you even think about failure? Just stay away from failure. Just focus on your customers, evolving your product. And so they're under similar veins, but I'm confused on who's right and who's wrong.
Interesting. So listen, I haven't yet had a chance to read Rework, although I'm looking forward to it. And I'm a big fan of the work that that Jason and those guys are doing. I do think there are some differences between their model and the Lean Startup. And I think those differences stem a lot from the fact that our goals are slightly different. You know, the kinds of companies they're encouraging people to build are different than the kinds of companies I'm encouraging people to build. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that it's important that we be really clear about who the advice is for and why we're doing it. Now, I don't know specifically what they mean by don't look at failure, but that does strike me as an idea that would get me a little bit nervous, and here's why. My focus is to get people to learn as much as they can by whatever means necessary. And so I've often worked with entrepreneurs who have actually had initial success. I mean, there's an essay on my blog. It's called Validated Learning About Customers that is about a startup that I was working with that had something like $1 million in revenue already. And my contention was that they were actually worse off than a different company I was talking about that had only $40,000 in revenue. And people were like, well, how can that be? How can having less revenue be better? But my point of view was at the earliest stages, what matters is how much are you learning? And this particular company that I was writing about, they hadn't learned anything. They were just really good salespeople. They kind of made the early sales, but they were moving in 20 different directions. Whereas the company that had a smaller amount of revenue but had been very disciplined about how they got it, measuring what they were doing, understand the cost per acquisition and their revenue per customer, they were in a position to enter a phase of dramatic growth, whereas the other company was not. So I don't think from a psychological point of view it's possible to learn without failing. Because most of us as humans, and certainly all of us as entrepreneurs, are experts. We have like a built-in biological superpower called instantaneous after-the-fact rationalization. So whatever happened, that's what we were expecting to happen. No problem, right? You ever notice that when people are giving you product updates? Have you ever been in a board meeting with a startup especially? And you say, you know, they're like, hey, we've got, you know, 300,000 website hits this month. It's awesome. You say, well, how many website hits were you expecting? Oh, definitely. This is just what, you know, this is better than what we expected. But if you actually go back and read the minutes from the last meeting, not only did that not come up, but actually quite often website hits weren't even the metric of choice last month, right? That we assigned the goalpost to be wherever we actually wound up on the field instead of explicitly setting a goal and then measuring ourselves against that goal. That's why failing faster. It's all, like, we always talk about failure, but really we should be talking about learning. Learning is the goal. My experience has been if you make a well thought through and disciplined prediction, you say, because of what I believe about how customers will behave, because of what I believe about our product and the problem it solves, therefore I can make certain predictions about what will happen when customers see our product. 3% of them will download, 10% of them will purchase. Well, you know, whatever our prediction is. Then when those numbers turn out to be incorrect, as they often do, especially in the early stages, that can be an opportunity not to castigate ourselves, but to say, okay, well, what's different about reality than what we were expecting, right? Let's call that failure, and then let's go see what we can discover about that. When we were at InView, I remember very early on we set sales targets for our company. I think the first month we were supposed to make $300 that whole month. And then 350 and four. We had this whole sale, you know, revenue curve plotted out. And we would meet with investors often and they would say, hey, what are the units of this graph? Is that in thousands? We would have to say, no, it's in ones. Because we were setting really embarrassingly small targets. But we figured before you can make $1 million, you got to make $100. And what happened was, you know, after a couple months of being able to sell it to our friends and families, we literally ran out of friends. And we could not find more people who would buy the product. And we couldn't figure it out. You know, every day we were spending like $5 a day on Google AdWords, bringing in, you know, buying like 100 clicks a day. And that meant every single day, 100 people were deciding not to buy our product. And then as we were making the product better and better, it became harder and harder for us to kid ourselves that we were actually making the product better, right? We were making the product better from our point of view, but the numbers don't lie. People aren't buying it. And it was that sense of failure of kind of our expectations compared to our results that kind of forced us to start to do things like actually talk to customers face to face and try to understand why they weren't behaving the way that we were. And, you know, long and short of it was we discovered that our sense of what the value proposition for InView was, we used to think it was about hanging out with your friends online. We eventually discovered it was about making new friends online. And you might say, that's not a very big difference. You know, that seems pretty minor. But actually, from our customer's point of view, it was a radically different product, you know, with that value proposition versus the other. And so that kind of learning would never have happened if we hadn't set those targets and then kind of set ourselves up to fail at achieving them. Because if we had, if we'd done it the standard way, we would have put this product out there, and then whatever happened, we would have said, yep, that's what we expected. Hey, we didn't make any money, but we sure got a lot of downloads. Or we didn't get any downloads, but we sure got a lot of press mentions or whatever the vanity metric of the day was. That, to me, is why failure is so important and why we have to get away from this thing I call success theater, borrowing a term from Bruce Schneier, who coined the term security theater. The idea is the work that we do to make it seem like we're being successful, which as entrepreneurs we tend to be really good at. And I say, enough with that. Let's get comfortable with talking about failure, and let's be candid about what's working and not working so that can give us an opportunity to learn and improve.
So to sort of zoom out and put a few sentences on that, it sounds like what you're describing failure as is an educated way of actually describing what you're going to do and getting to the end of doing that and realizing whether it was a success or failure and learning from it.
Yes, I think that's exactly right.
So your term on failure is completely different than what most people probably think failure really is, because I would say, you know, a company's a failure, but did you actually, or this product is a failure, this iteration's a failure, but did you actually plan it out and gauge the fail or not fail on this plan?
That's so right. And in fact, by changing our definition of what we're trying to do with each iteration, we can actually change the definition of success and failure, and then we can stop talking about failure altogether. Because if our goal of an iteration is explicitly to learn something about customers, then we can say, well, did we learn anything? And then it can be perfectly acceptable. It can be a huge victory to say, we thought that we knew our customers really well and they would really like this feature. They didn't, and therefore we learned whatever, and that learning can be the thing that we celebrate. And that can, you know, I think that as a company culture point of view, you kind of drive that learning attitude through the whole organization. I've seen that be very, very powerful in terms of it really dramatically enhancing the speed of iteration that a company can go through. Because we live in a world where, software is creativity made real. So what's in people's heads is primarily the asset that companies have. And therefore, the speed at which we can evolve their thinking, the thinking of our own employees, is the fundamental rate limiter of progress. And, you know, when we change our focus from like building widgets to learning about customers, we unlock a lot of potential that's usually latent in most organizations.
We've got a few questions that Caitlin wants to ask. But before we go on to some of her questions, I do have one more question. It's mostly a plug because I think this is really an admirable thing that you're doing. And I'm not too familiar on all the details, so I might just describe it completely wrong. But from what I understand, you mentioned earlier about being on a plane and doing some geeky stuff in other countries, and that all stems from Geeks on a Plane with Dave McClure. But recently you had a trip to D.C. with Startup Visa D.C., and
yep.
You went there and you were doing something with to promote the Startup Visa Job Creation Bill. Can you quickly just talk about what that is and where your passions stem from with Startup Visa?
Thanks for giving me a chance to talk about that. This is one of my first forays into public policy, so it's been a really learning experience for me personally. But I'm really proud of the success that we've had so far, you know, like I said, so far. So for people who are interested, you can go to startupvisa.com to get the details. I'll give the very short version here. The idea is we want to create a new class of visas for foreign entrepreneurs who want to come to the United States and start a company with money from American investors. People who are in that particular category right now cannot get a visa to come work in the United States. And our point of view is that every founder that we turn away is hundreds or potentially thousands of lost American jobs. And so in a time of 10% unemployment, we think it's absolutely tragic to send somebody like that away. So you got to imagine somebody working right now on a student visa in a PhD program somewhere, working on some new piece of technology, they can come here, they can study in the United States. You know, they're already in the country. We've invested as a society a lot of time, energy, resources, money in their education and their development. And then right at the moment when they want to change from being a net consumer of resources to a job creator, that is the moment they want to actually incorporate that company and start creating jobs, that's the moment we want to send them back to their home country. To me, that just seems crazy. So 2 weeks ago now, Senators Kerry and Lugar introduced the 2010 Startup Visa Act into the Senate. It establishes what we think is a very fair process for evaluating who should get that visa. Again, people encourage you to look at the website if you are interested. What I will say is this is a proposal that doesn't cost anything. It doesn't create any net new visas. We're just amending an existing visa category, so we're not dramatically changing existing law. And it's a proposal that has bipartisan and bicameral support in the Congress, so we're very excited about it.
And so what got you going down this road then? What turned you on to this subject? Not to take it even further, but this is – and maybe we can even spin this off into a whole separate conversation that goes beyond this episode. But I'm very interested in like what got you involved in – I mean obviously your history as an entrepreneur, but you know specifically this subject.
Well, I've always had an interest in politics and in public policy making personally. And I've – you know my grandparents were immigrants to this country. And I've been the incredible beneficiary of being able to live in a place like Silicon Valley, being able to move here whenever I wanted to and you know, immediately plug into this ecosystem. And I feel like I love this country. I think it has done incredible things for me. And when we were on this trip to D.C. last year that Dave McClure organized, we were meeting with policymakers all day. And by the time we got to the end of the day, I was thinking to myself, all right, enough talking. What could we actually do that would make this country a better place, that would help with the most pressing problems, and that could bring a little bit of what we have learned about what works for job creation in Silicon Valley to the greater nation. And you know, when we actually sorted through the ideas that way, the Startup Visa, which you know Paul Graham had written about, which Brad Feld had written about, you know, that issue kind of bubbled immediately to the top, and we said, hey, let's try to get some grassroots support for that. And it was actually, we started with blog posts and tweets. Hey, if you believe in the Startup Visa, here's an easy way using a company called TuGov to contact your representative. And it was this like groundswell of support that came out of that that then got us all these meetings with policymakers and kind of got the ball rolling. And we eventually joined forces with a separate initiative that Brad Feld had been working on with Congressman Jared Polis. So, you know, we were much more successful much more quickly than we expected, but it was really grounded in the fact that there's a huge public outpouring of support for this idea, you know, not just in Silicon Valley, but in all the startup hubs around the country, and even some pretty unlikely places. So that's kind of how it all started.
Well, I think anything that could take some knowledge that's already here, like you said, somebody who's here studying for their PhD or doing some very specific work or studying or research, and to ship them way back to their country and not give them an opportunity to get started here with American money and create jobs. I mean, that's just... I think anything to create jobs in today's market is a good thing. So I commend you for standing up and...
Oh, thank you very much. And again, if anyone's interested in learning more, startupvisa.com.
Well, Caitlin, you've been sitting here waiting in the wings all this time. I kind of feel bad that you didn't really get a word in edgewise, but I hear we have some Twitter questions. I hear we have some questions from the LinkedIn community that follows the Web 2.0 Expo. Can you enlighten us on what people want to know from Eric?
Sure, and first off, don't feel bad at all. This has been a great discussion, so I'm enjoying it thoroughly. Don't worry about me. But yeah, I have a few questions from the audience. We tweeted out on our Twitter account, obviously, and through our Facebook group and LinkedIn account. You know, if you have any questions for Eric, please tell us what they are. And so here are the don't worry, they're very positive. So the first one we have comes from Tweep the Leg, which is a great handle, by the way. The question is, what are some effective methods to bootstrap without seeking out investors?
So one common misconception people have about the lean startup because of the word lean in the title is that it's about being cheap. And that has actually been brought a lot of people into the movement who have kind of been like, hey, is this a way for me to save money? My outside investors are telling me, hey, spend less money. And when I ask them, spend less money on what? They say things like, well, you're the entrepreneur. You figure it out. So there's a lot of people who are like, hey, how do we figure out what costs are the right ones to cut? Obviously, bootstrappers are at the forefront of innovations in that area because they're trying to grow out of their organic revenue stream, you know, directly from customers, which is a model I really commend. But when you start cutting costs, if you cut costs that cause you to slow down, then you're actually just going out of business more slowly. You're not actually making progress faster. And so running lean is really about optimizing the money that we do spend rather than about minimizing every dollar that we spend. As a bootstrapper, the key issue is how can I get that early revenue from early adopters? And so bootstrappers, even more than venture-backed companies, have to be extremely disciplined to figure out what are the specific pain points that my customers have, who are the early adopters that have that pain most acutely, and then how do I reach them and get early pre-orders? If anyone is trying to bootstrap and figure out those questions and they haven't read Steve Blank's book, The Four Steps to the Epiphany, the original book about customer development, you're crazy. You can read Steve's blog at steveblank.com. You can go on my blog, and I've got a review of his book and the whole thing. So there's a lot of resources to get the introduction to see if that's something you want to do. The other thing I'll say, though, is I often counsel people to sell pre-orders of their product before it's ready. And even before they know what the product is, to try to sell a pre-order of magic. So like one technique is to put up a landing page that offers to solve a certain problem for people for a certain price and doesn't exactly say how that problem is going to be solved. And then just say, hey, click here to learn more, click here to sign up, and see if you can get anybody to click through that landing page. And on the next page, you don't have to be deceptive about it. The next page, you can disclose what's going on and ask them if they'd like to get more information. You'll get in touch with them, etc. If you can't sell magic, then you don't have early adopters. You haven't actually figured out what your product is yet. Because before you can figure out what product to build, you got to be figuring out what problem to solve. And so I think even, especially for bootstrappers, that's got to be the first and foremost question.
AJ Pape on Twitter. My question for Eric is, what are the top three mistakes people make around teamwork and leadership, and how do you solve them? Thanks.
Ooh, these questions are tough. There's no top three. I'll do the top one because it's the most important thing by a landslide, which is we're used to thinking of startups as shrunken down big companies. It's what I call the startup dollhouse fallacy. And we're like, look, big companies have departments. So if you want to be a real company, you have to have departments. And therefore, we should hire people into a startup, who are superstars. And then we should get them to really specialize in being as good as possible at their function and to hire other superstars at that same function, because like that's our model for how people are supposed to work together in a company. And I just think that is a terrible model. The best thing for startups is cross-functional collaboration, not siloed individual departmental collaboration. And so all of the team building techniques that I urge people to use, from simple stuff like Scrum to more complicated things like actually judging people's individual performance based on the team performance and not based on like how well they write code. It's all designed around forcing people from design, from engineering, from marketing, from sales to all really collaborate together closely and be jointly accountable for results. That's the most important team issue in startups by, that should be issues 1 through 3.
All right. So normally I ask a closing question, but since you have almost no more time because you got to rush off to lunch, and I appreciate you taking the hour that you have to be on the call with us and talk about what you're doing and especially the intensive you're doing at the Web 2.0 Expo. I think that's awesome. So if you plan to be at the Web 2.0 Expo, make sure you see Eric and his intensive and learn about the new path for product development. But Eric, I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. I love what you're doing with Startup Lessons Learned, and I love with the whole startup methodology. Obviously, past guests have essentially said, Adam, you have to have Eric on your show at some point because they just keep mentioning your blog and what you're doing. And, I hear Dave McClure's name. I hear Sean Ellis's name. I hear Kissmetrics' name quite a bit. So I figured at some point, I have to have you on the show. So I appreciate, Caitlin, you making that happen and the partnership with Web 2.0 Expo. And Eric, again, for you coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Adam.
Hey, thank you very much. It was really my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Web 2.0 Show. Be sure to check out web20show.com for links in the show notes or to leave a comment on the show. Thanks for listening.